Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to our podcast, a football fans podcast and the people behind CelticUnderground.net. It's been a while. So, good sort of 25 years ago now, guy I worked for came up to me and said, I think you'd be really interested in listening to these tapes in the car when you're out and about. So, put them in the car, tapes. There's no such thing as MP3 players at the time. Cars didn't even have CD players in them, so I put the tapes in. I was listening to this guy called Jack Black from a company called Mindstore, and it sort of blew my mind. It blew my mind for a couple of reasons. One, because he was talking about stuff that, some of it blew my mind because I thought everybody behaved like that. Another bit is because he just sort of talked so positively about lots of things in life and was very much on my wavelength. Anyway, so I think Celtic needs some positive thinking just now. Jack has worked famously with Rangers. If anybody's ever heard of him will know that. But he's worked with lots of sports people. He talks about his time with Rangers. He is a big Celtic fan. He has worked with Celtic. He's a coach, author, works a lot with businesses on professional and personal development. Very much around the positive thinking and the power of positive thinking. He talks a bit about NLP in this as well. So anyway, enough of all that. I thought Celtic could do some positive thinking just now. So enough of this. This is me, Harry Brady, talking to him, Jack Black of Mindstore. What was your first Celtic game, and who was your first Celtic hero?
Well, this is a question that you ask all the time. It's always great to hear the answers. I mean, my first Celtic match is a 65. World Cup, the Cup final, big Billy McNeil scoring the header. I'm 10 years old. My dad's got me at, you know, up on his shoulder. There's 100,000 of us in Hampden. It was just unbelievable. But the funny thing, and my favourite player back then was Jim Baxter of Rangers, mm-hmm. which is really bizarre. And the reason is because I grew up in Cumbernauld, really, and right next door to us, there was this guy who was Rangers mad. And every Thursday, you'd see him leaving. He'd be playing football in the streets, and he'd be leaving a little brown bag, sort of briefcase, all suited up, heading down to presumably the lodge or whatever. And what happened was he started giving me, when I was like 7 or 8 or 9, he'd start giving me Rangers programmes and talk about the players to me and give me posters. And nobody else had them, and so I would put them up in my bed. My dad let me put them up in the bedroom wall. Mm-hmm. And so Jim Baxter and maybe Jim Forrest or something, these are names that I remember from back then. And then obviously my father and my uncles and all this stuff, they get really concerned about it. So he takes me to that famous match. And from that moment on, you know, Celtic nuts, you know, just can't get enough of it.
So we need to get why I thought it'd be a fantastic idea to have you on the podcast, and there I am, I'm using the positive terminology already. Right, fantastic. So do you want to set out, I first came across you with a boss of mine 25 years ago, gave me some tapes and said, I think you'll like this. And as we talked about before came on the podcast, I was blown away. I was blown away in part because you were describing something that I thought everybody did and realised that not everybody did. But you were also talking other ways about stuff. So do you want to describe what it is that people might know you from?
What happened, Harry, was I used to be a social worker in the East End of Glasgow, Easter House. I'm saying East End of Glasgow because usually it's an international audience, but it's Harry Brady. So Easter House, I was a social worker and youth worker there, ran Easter House Youth Centre. And cut long story short, three people involved. One of them was my mother-in-law, and two involved in social work and education. Three people within a fortnight dropped down dead on me. You would never have thought they were going to drop down dead the day before they did. Mm-hmm. And one was a heart attack, one was a stroke, one was something that was going on in their brain with a tumour they didn't know they had. And when it happened, it really upset me, and for all sorts of reasons, for the obvious reasons as well. But what happened was I started to ask questions about why did they die? You know, why are they? And I believe in something bigger than probably, you know, than all of us put together to some extent, still believe in that stuff. And I thought, well, why? And I figured out it was stress, Harry. When 30 years ago in Glasgow, especially in a place like Easter House, nobody would talk about stress. That was for wimps, you know. Mm-hmm. And but the truth was, it was stress. And it's a long story. And I went out to, I decided to change my career at that point. I was running skiing trips. I mean, there used to be snow every weekend in the winter from Glasgow through Cumbernauld up to Glenshee. And it went really well. I'm getting to group travel and stuff. And then what happened was I was working about 40 hours a week in my business, and I was 40 hours a week a social worker, and I collapsed in a hairdresser, Betty Riley's in Oak Street. And it was the collapsing and realising I was getting my first, maybe my last warning, that I was now stressed out in my mind. And I realised I had to go and do something about it. And I literally left the hairdressers, went round the corner into John Smith's bookstore, a book fell off the shelf, and that kicked me off in this. And I then realised that most people have no idea that their thinking has a massive impact on their lives, quality of their life, the outcomes in their life. And if people could learn to change how they were thinking, they could change literally everything. This at a simple level. And stress could be managed by the changing of thinking, mindset, and it could be changed by managing stress through something like we now call meditation, although back when I started, that freaked people out, so I had to introduce it slowly. But meditation's now mainstream, mindfulness, that sort of stuff, deep relaxation. So I was teaching, I figured out those four things. To be extraordinary, you need to be managing your stress, bags of energy, be positive, be a, what I call a futurist. This is what upsets me about Celtic particularly. There's all the fans, there's all the staff, there's all the players, do all the backroom staff, do all the management, do all the executives all know what the goal is. Nobody has a clue. But extraordinary men and women are very clear about what it is they want. I describe them as futurists. And then, not to go into any great detail, but they're using both sides of their brain, which goes back to a Nobel Prize in 1981. So I put together a program around that stuff, started knocking on doors, and it gradually took off. And then I got a big, you know, I started getting insurance companies taking me in. And I would teach the stuff, and then salespeople. I started working with a lot of sales, but still work with salespeople around the world to this day. And one day, in one of the courses I was doing up in Dundee, was my Colgan's financial advisor was in the audience, and I'm talking away about my stuff. It's a 2-day or 4-day course I was doing. And I don't know, I mentioned her because of the way that she lost the gold medal in the Seoul Olympics. She comes in second. I won't go into the story, it took too long. But basically, I said she lost that because of her thinking. She should have won the gold medal. And he came up to me and said, "Are you serious about that?" I said, "I really am." He said, "Well, Les McColgan's a great friend of mine and a client. I'll put you in touch with her if you want." And I'd been thinking for about, I don't know, for years and years and years, I'd love to get a hold of her. And there I was in her front room. And I start explaining it all. And then I convince her to work with me. And then she goes off and comes back with a world championship from Tokyo, gold medal, 10,000 metres, and built up a great relationship with her. And that just led to other athletes. And then, but I'd always been wanting to work with Celtic. Mm-hmm. Right from day one, Celtic mad, and I'm thinking I can make a difference here. And I would just write letters. I mean, back then when it was letters, I remember Davy Proven, I used to really like him as a player. I don't like him so much now, but I liked him as a player. And when he went to Aberdeen and he got ME, I thought I can help him. And I'd send letters, and it got me nowhere. And then eventually, I mean, I'm getting my Celtic stories, but eventually, a long story short, but I start to get into see managers, and that progresses from there. But I work with loads of teams.
Well, yeah, so, I mean, obviously, I'm sure you'll have confidentiality agreements that you can't talk about certain teams and can't talk about certain people, but I do recall when I was handed these tapes about you, there's a number of things that really struck me, and a lot of it was talk about visualization. Yeah. A lot of it was how you engage with people, that positivity. One of the things that always thought was interesting. I subsequently come across people who I think have been introduced to, if it's not yourself, at Mindstore, other types of things, where I sometimes, I remember, because I work in property, in the 2008 crash, because you talk a lot about, and people doing your type of thing talk a lot about, don't use negative words.
Yes.
People who, without sounding superior here, but I did come across a lot of people who patently had listened to this stuff but hadn't really absorbed it, were unable to talk about crap happening.
Yes.
Using normal vocabulary, because they've been told. One of the things I remember vividly you saying was, you speak to someone in Glasgow and you say, how are you doing? And they'll say, not bad. Two negatives in the one sentence.
Yes.
And it's amazing the difference in people. If when you ask how somebody's doing, somebody turns around to you and says, great, fantastic, brilliant.
Yeah.
Now, I did find in 2008 when the market was crashing, lots of people couldn't cope with how to say the market's crap. Because they weren't allowed to say the market's crap.
Well, the classic thing is to say, well, it could be better right now. You know, that's the way to say it.
Yes. So, I came across people coming. One of the things I remember was in these tapes, you talking about you'd been working with Rangers, which is interesting because you said you always wanted to speak with Celtic.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you could share with people the story. I always remember you telling the story about being in the dressing room and asking what competitions they were going to win and how they reacted to it. So people haven't heard you talk about that. Because for me, this is the crux about how a football team can succeed.
Yeah. Aye. There's quite a lot of stories around it. I mean, eventually, I got my break with various smaller clubs, and then eventually Rangers had heard about what I was doing. I got a phone call from Walter Smith, who I think's one of my mates winding me up, to be honest. And, you know, my PA comes in and says, Walter Smith's on the phone. And I'm like, aye, so he is, you know, sort of thing. And I'm pretty sure it's one of my mates. And he says, you know, Jack, we've heard about all the amazing things you're doing. Could you come and help us? We're playing Celtic in the semi-final. And my first thought was, I realised it was him, you know, and I thought, I'll come and screw you up. You know, this was my instant thought, I'll come and screw you all up. But to be honest, at that point, I hadn't got into Celtic, and I'd been doing so much, you know, pushing myself to get into Celtic without any success. Although I met quite a few of the managers and stuff. I thought, well, why not? I mean, Celtic's had their chance, so I'm going to go and help these guys. And so anyway, I go along. I didn't know what to expect, but I end up working with all the players and all the backroom people were there who wanted to be, and some of the old players were in, and whoever was available, and I spent a day with them or so. And one of the things I asked them was, how many of you think you will win the Scottish Cup? Remember, they're playing Celtic in the semi-final. And, I mean, every one of them, to a man, were like, yes, you know, it was just absolute belief in themselves. And I thought, bloody hell, you know, there's no Celtic's got no chance, because I just didn't perceive. And it was like Saturday watching them coming out, there just wasn't the belief. You need to have that psychology about yourself, you know. And then I said, okay, so then the obvious question, how many of you think you're going to win the league? And they were neck and neck with Aberdeen at the time. And again, the same old answer, yes, we're going to win the league and stuff. And they were looking at one another. And I'm like, bloody hell. So I then asked the question, well, if you win the league, that means you'll play in the Champions League, the European Cup. How many of you think you'll win the European Cup? And much to my delight, none of them thought it. They couldn't even look at me. And I thought, yes, because as a Celtic fan, we don't want them to win the European Cup, do you? So the point is, But that was fascinating for me, because there you've got the psychology of, we're big boys in a small pond, but frightened to go into the bigger pond. And so we worked our way at that. And funnily enough, they got to the club in the semi-final that year. And ultimately the team that beat them were cheating, and that was Marseille. Mm-hmm. So it's fascinating. I had a great experience just working there, and some great stories, you know, that I can tell. Totally. Sure. About McCoist and stuff like that. Just good stuff, you know.
Well, so how do you start that process? Because as you mentioned earlier about in Scotland, we're very We're getting better, but we're very poor at considering mental health and mental attitudes and things. I've got my friend's wife is certain that the reason Scotland national team fails is because that's not for us type attitude in Scotland. We're not quite good enough for that tight attitude for Scotland. I mean, she's a strong supporter of independence, and that's why she thinks it all comes from a lack of nationhood and things like that. But we do have quite a barrier, and that's a load of shite type attitude to what you propose. So how do you overcome that when you go in there and you're brought in by someone like Walter Smith? He might believe in it, but what if his backroom staff don't believe in it? What if the players don't believe in it? What if they give you... They nod to your existence because the manager says they must, but deep down they're not believing it. How do you deal with that?
Well, first of all, I mean, because I've talked to thousands of audiences all around the world, and so you very quickly get used to non-verbal communication, shall we say, right? And so one of the things you've got to do is pull them in. I use lots of tricks to hold an audience's attention. And what I'm clear about is I need to get on board the people who are influencers, and I'll figure out fairly quickly who they are, and I'll see if I can engage them, either getting them up on the stage to do something, or I'll ask them specific questions and so on. I mean, famously, just to go off for a point, Sven-Göran Eriksson was a BBC documentary about the English team when he took over. You may remember that England, to use a nice Glasgow word, were gubbed by West Germany, and about 20 minutes after being gubbed at Wembley, Kevin Keegan resigns.
Mm-hmm. That's right, yep.
Dramatic resignation, and they go out and they do something completely different. They go and get a foreigner, you know, and remember the headlines, they were actually racially unbelievable. I mean, how they could get away with it, they would have just disgusted the English. It wasn't a good old English boy. So they go and get Sven, and the BBC run this fly in the wall documentary thing about him, and it was amazing because the first thing he does is he realises that if England go 1-0 down, they collapse mentally. And he knew it was a mindset thing, and he talks about that. And so what he does is he goes to Oslo University. I remember it was Oslo, and he brings a professor to work with them guys. And what happens is, the professor says very quickly, and this is the truth for everybody listening to this, in any group of people, in any sort of team of people or any organisation, there are what he called cultural architects. They're the men and or the women who create the culture. It's not something that you've got in a statement in a business. It's actually a handful of people that actually are able to influence. They're influencers. And he said, if you're lucky, they're positive, but the chances are they're probably negative. But you need to know who they are. And so Sven, armed with this, looks at the team and he realises that Rio Ferdinand is without doubt an influencer, as is the centre forward, young guy, played for Liverpool, went to St.
Owen.
Owen. And David Beckham and a few others. And I think there's six of them. And what happens is he gets the six together first and he brings in the professor. And these guys, because they're influencers, are smart enough to be able to have the conversation. Not every footballer I found was bright. A lot of them are, but not all of them. But these guys were all bright and they had a very, let's say, adult conversation about the role that they play in the team. In influencing stuff. And so what basically was a negotiation that said, we're going to introduce all this stuff that everybody else is going to think is nuts. But whenever it's challenged and joked about, you guys have got to turn and support it. It's got to be seen to be in agreement with me. And they all agreed to do that. And you just see it progressing to the point where they then play a return match with the Germans somewhere in Germany. I don't remember which stadium it was. But the BBC are filming it. They're not filming the match, they're filming the dynamic of what's been going on with Sven. And there comes a point in the match when Germany scores a goal, it's 1-0. Mm-hmm. And what you see is every player, because the BBC are watching the players, not the game, and every one of the players look to the dugout to see the reaction, because this is the real test. Because previous managers would be bawling and shouting and effing and blinding, and there's some really embarrassing, you know, shots of managers reacting stupidly when they've gone down a goal down. And Sven's doing this, you know, he's got his thumbs up, and he's to all the players around the field, come on, come on. And you see it, you can almost see the brains of the player going, God, he believes this. And they win 5-1. I mean, it's just, so some of the guys, well, it's a lot of pish, right? But it isn't. And so what happens is so what I did with Rangers, for example, was, and I had a go at this with the Celtic players as well, and it always wins. And this is how I finally got the gig with Liz McColgan, so I've used it ever since. And it's to do with something called kinesiology. Again, when you use something like that, the paradigm for doctors and medical people and physiotherapists and a backroom staff, they're just going to laugh their head at you because it's not their stuff and they can't get out of their paradigm. But I find I use kinesiology, which is muscle testing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got a few of the Rangers players out, two of them, and one of them was the big fella who, he was a left back or right back, he was playing for Scotland, he got an injury, and he was a young lad, he never played again. It was a real tragedy for the guy, really nice guy as well. And he's a big strapping lad, so he comes out, and I do this thing about, if you get somebody to hold their arm out, and you press their arm down,
mm-hmm.
They've got the strength to resist you. They can hold their arm straight out and push up, and you can feel the strength and the tension in their arms and the muscles. But if you give them a cigarette, for example, a toxin, it immediately loses strength. And I would do that, and they would go, God, what happened there? And everybody would laugh, and it'd be good. It's quite a good show when people are watching it.
Mm-hmm.
And then basically asking, okay, what if thoughts are toxins to the body? What if you think something that affects your strength? And so I did the classic with footballers, as I did with McCong, and I got them to think about losing, the word lose and the word win. And every time they would say lose, they would have no strength. And this big fella is looking at me as if I've done something to him, you know, and now the players are going, for God. And so they want a shot of it. And that's how I kind of win them over. And they say, look what happens when you're thinking win, and the strength's there. And they feel it and they know the difference. And then one of the things I did with them was, and I did it with other football teams, and Paul Lambert did it for the rest of his career when I showed him it when I was went in to see St Mirren with Davy Hay.
Mm-hmm.
Is a thing where I came across it with McColgan. I was working with McColgan, and I don't know how I came across it, but I came across a notion that if you wear artificial fibre near your skin, especially around your thymus gland, they think that's the seat of your immune system, then it has a toxic impact on your strength. And I found that if I got people to wear artificial fibre near their, especially up here, like an artificial shirt or a blouse or something, they would have no strength. So what I did was I got the Rangers player to come out. I asked them if they could get a Rangers strip. So way down in the dressing room somewhere, a Ranger strip comes up. And I said, okay, do you mind taking it? I'll take off. And they had sort of training gear on, sort of cotton type training tops. I had to take the cotton top off. And I tested him with nothing on. He's as strong as an ox. And I put the Ranger strip on and he's no strength. It just goes right away. I said, let's see what happens if you put the cotton strip back, the cotton top on again, strength's back, put the strip on top of it. You've still got the strength. And I said I'm discovering this as I'm going along. That's what I got McColgan. McColgan wouldn't believe it, but the girl who beat her in the Barcelona Olympics, although she was injured, the girl that won it wore a white cotton T-shirt underneath her Lycra top, and I told her to do it to McColgan. She just laughed. Her attitude was brilliant. She said, look, if we're all not wearing the cotton T-shirt, I'll still win. That was before she got injured, and I thought, that's brilliant. Great answer. You're right. Because what happens is your body normalises. I mean, just when you initially put it on, you feel the effect, but then it normalises, but not 100%. So there's some. So for me in football, does that mean you lose half a yard running for a ball? Does that mean that the interferes with your mind, so at a deeper level, your subconscious, so your pass goes astray, your corner goes out the other side of the park? And when I did it with the guys at St Mirren, with Chick Charnley, slagging me all the way through it and pissing himself laughing. And I'm pissing myself laughing with him because he's just that one of those guys. And you realise, I'm not going to win me. But later on, I met him much later on and he said, I shouldn't have taken the piss out of you that day because what you were talking about was real. Paul Lambert, he did the most. He wore the white cotton T-shirt under his strip. And, of course, he becomes a European Cup winner. I mean, I'm not claiming anything, but the point is there's a lot of consistency with that. And I use those kind of things to win guys over. And so, and I've also got cool tools for anxiety because a lot of the players, I mean, I've witnessed in dressing rooms, international players, I'm not saying which club because I can't, but so nervous and so anxious, having to go into the loo and spew before they could put the strip on.
Mm-hmm.
And this is every match. And you see silly things like, you know, players. I get concerned about some of the things players do before big matches. I used to get really annoyed at Celtic in Europe when they would. There's no concentration the first 15 minutes or so. Everybody hiding. Nobody wanting the ball. Because their clarity of thought wouldn't be there. And part of the reason for it is what they're being told by these scientists, what they should be drinking or eating just before they go out or near the park. And so there's sweets, high sugar content products available for them. And if you pump yourself up with sugar, your clarity of thought disappears almost immediately. For 10, 15 minutes, you're going to be recovered. And it's simple things like that I've learn from my experience, you know, just endless experience. There are simple things that you could do to give a player half a yard or a mindset click. And, you know, when I was working with Dundee United the way it began, I learned so much from Jim McLean. I got a lot of respect for the guy, unbelievable. But I could write books about Jim McLean. And when I got to Dundee United, I mean, there were players literally last 40th minute of a match. For the next 5 minutes, nobody wanted the ball. Not a player. And at 85 minutes, nobody wanted the ball. Not a player. The simple reason is you get in the dressing room, you get beat up if you make a mistake in the last 5 minutes. And I used to say, you're better than the win there. And let Paul Sturrock do the thing at half time. And to be fair to him, he understood it. He got it. But
he just couldn't bring himself to do it.
A passion, you know, it's like, I mean, it's like you, with respect to you after Ferencváros, Harry, you know. you only expressed how we were all feeling and how we would have said the exact same thing. I'm sure everybody who listened to it was just inspired by what you said because it was true. It was where we were at. If you're a Celtic fan, that's exactly how you felt. And you're kidding yourself on if you didn't. You're not really a Celtic fan then because we live and breathe this thing. And so Jimmy and the other managers, I've literally witnessed, I'm not saying who it was, but I've witnessed in a dressing room the teacups flying. I've been there. I've had to dodge one. I could, you know, if I was allowed to say, I could write. It's the mindset thing in football is amazing. And if people don't understand the power of thought, even to the point of what is the vision here? What are we all, why do we come to work every day? Why does anybody go into Celtic Park or go into Lennox Town or go and watch a player somewhere on behalf of the team somewhere in the world? Why are they doing it? There only has to be one reason, Harry, and that is to win the European Cup again. It's got to be as big as that or there's no point.
And
they might never do it again, but that's what everybody should be aligned to.
And that's my issue with the club at the moment is that's my vision for Celtic.
Yeah.
In my lifetime,
yeah.
I will be at another European final.
Exactly.
I was at Seville and I'll be at another. I've just turned 50, so I'd like to think I've got 50 years left for Celtic to reach another European final. And I see no reason why they can't. Mm. My issue is I believe the people who run the club's ambition is for Celtic to be the best team in Scotland.
I agree.
And
they're not even good at that at the moment.
No, and I hear people coming up with this false paradox of, would you rather win 10 in a row or be successful in Europe? And my attitude is always really simple. I want to be successful in Europe. Because see, if we are successful in Europe, we will be successful in Scotland, because the success in Europe will drag us through on that. A lot of what you're talking about, I remember speaking to someone once in football who owned a football club, and he was always saying that he never wanted his manager to speak to the players after a defeat at the end of 90 minutes, because what was the point?
Exactly.
Because the player, because all he would do is go in, shout at the players, and the players would have that negative thought until, if it was a Saturday night, until the Monday morning when they were back in, or a Tuesday when they were back in the training ground. So what was the point in giving them that negativity for 48 hours?
Yeah.
I mean, if you lose a game, just go in, get changed and go home.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right, Harry. Again, all this stuff is common sense. You don't need to be someone like me, all my experience, going to groups and working with teams and stuff in different industries. It's common sense. I mean, what I loved about Jim McLean was we got there on a Saturday, say, and I got them to change what they were eating and stuff. I managed to get success because I brought in a professor from Aberdeen University and they agreed to speak to him, and it was fantastic. And Jim was always, to be fair to him, looking for an edge. And what he used to do was we'd come back from lunch, players were getting themselves ready. And we'd sit in his office and there'd be a journalist there, Dick, whatever his name was.
Dick Donnelly,
a few other journalist guys, some of the old players that had retired. And I'm sitting there, and he would say, so tell me your team for today. And he would let every one of them pick their team. Or he would say, like, who's the goalkeeper today, who's the left back, whatever. And then he would say, well, let me tell you what the team is, and I'll tell you why. And you'd just be sitting there with your jaw dropped, because he's so amazing as a strategist in football. I mean, he obviously did amazing in Europe for the team. And you just sit and look at the genius in the man. But then the game would kick off and then stuff happened. And there was nothing he could do at full time that would be any use to Andy. But the same man cools down, comes in on Monday and sits the guys down. The growth in the team would have been phenomenal. And one of the issues you've got with footballers, and it happened to me most of the time, was the first question you ask is, what do you know about football? Nothing, I'm just a fan. But I know tons of things about the mind. Mm-hmm. And that's the issue, is overcoming that resistance, because we're football people. But what was interesting was I went from team to team to team. And most of the time they called me. It wasn't in the initial days I was chapping the doors because I really wanted to get to Celtic. I talked about visualisation earlier on. I mean, I started visualising being in the dugout, looking across to the then jungle and seeing the players playing, and I'm sitting in the dugout. And I would visualise this every night before I went to bed. I was practising what I was preaching. First thing in the morning, think it again. And, you know, I ended up in the dugout looking over at the jungle, but I was with Dundee United. I never clarified it had to be Celtic.
Do you know, so as you're talking through the Sven Göran Eriksson thing reminded me of a couple of things. One, I remember going to one of these conferences and the guest speaker was Sir Clive Woodward.
Oh, yes, yes.
I remember he'd obviously just won the Rugby World Cup with England, and he stood up and he was saying the opposite of what you just, or a similar theme to what you've just said about football. He stood up and said, you'll all be sitting here, property people, saying, what's a rugby coach going to tell you about business?
Yeah.
And then proceeds to tell people, and I'm sure there were people in the room who left that room still thinking, what's a rugby guy told me about business? But I left that room thinking, that's brilliant. And I fully understand why Southampton hired him as a director of football down the line.
Yeah.
Because one of the things he talked about was he got the players to agree their set of rules for how the squad was going to behave at that Rugby World Cup, so that they all had to buy in because they bought into it.
Yeah.
He also talked about how he couldn't understand why they were the poorest they played was the first 5 minutes of the second half in every game.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he said it was a passing comment to someone who talked about what do you do, and he felt he behaved the same way at halftime as he did before the game began. And the only thing this person said was, because they were very good in the first 5 minutes of the start of a game, but very poor the first five. And the only thing the person then said to him was something about the strip.
Yeah.
They're sitting there for the 10, 15 minutes of halftime in their dirty gear while you're talking away to them, getting cold and damp because rugby players are diving around. And he said, so one of the things he then insisted upon was a complete change of kit. So he said they would come in, and actually the halftime routine was straight in, into the shower, dry off, brand new kit on, so they felt pristine. And as he's telling me this, I'm remembering watching a programme about Tony Jacklin when he did the Ryder Cup for Europe, and he insisted, Europe had been knocking at the, I think Europe had got close, Britain had always been, when it was Britain and Ireland, they hadn't been, Europe had got close, they'd drawn with America or something in America, and he took over and said, I'm not doing this unless the players have got cashmere jumpers. They all look the same. Trousers look the same. Yeah. And they flew to America on Concorde.
Wow.
And his reason behind it was, I'm telling these players that they are the best that Europe's got to offer, but we're flying on a standard commercial flight, scheduled flight. We're not doing a charter flight. Everything about what they should be making them feel the best. And those things always chimed with me. Then I read things like books like Soconomics, and it berates football for a couple of million, an asset of millions of pounds. If you had an executive in a business, you wouldn't just leave them at the front door and say, there's a taxi to find yourself in a new city you've never been in before. Yeah. And football was dreadful for this. And also this culture that people expect football managers to shout at them.
Yeah.
And I've never understood that, because who listening to this would respond to their boss coming in, shouting and swearing at them and walking out the room? Nobody would.
No.
And then Brendan Rodgers comes along at Celtic.
Yeah.
And Brendan Rodgers is embodying all of this stuff that I have heard from successful people who succeeded in sport. Sven-Göran Eriksson thumbs up thing.
Yeah.
And Brendan Rodgers arrives and we have an invincible season. And I always remember when we were, the game we beat Motherwell 4-3. When we were, was it 3-1 down at half time or 2-0 down? I can't remember exactly now.
Yep.
And being interviewed by on the BBC after the game, and whoever it was said, I'm sure there was some choice words at half time with the players. And as he's saying that, I'm thinking, I'm sure there wasn't.
Yeah.
And Brendan Rodgers laughs.
Aye.
And says,
why?
why would I do that?
Exactly.
We sat down and took the players individually and spoke to them about changes that they individually needed to be taken. But the most important thing we needed was a calm environment to change things.
Yeah, absolutely.
And everything you're saying and everything that you'd said and the tapes that I'd heard and then the successful people, everything seemed to be embodied in Brendan Rodgers. Could you see that in Brendan Rodgers?
The first thing about it is, I mean, when I would go into any club, I think, you know, you're up against this, like, what do you know about football? You're not a footballer, so you don't know anything, blah, blah. But then, and then, so very often the medical people would be challenged by me coming in, you know, so they would block me and stuff and undermine me when the players were getting their sessions. But then Rodgers, you know, he comes in and he's already studied neuro-linguistic programming. He's a practitioner of these dark arts. So he knows exactly how to do everything. And, of course, he gives them all that dossier stuff. The guy was bringing professionalism of the 21st century from the business world and from every world of excellence into football management. And the guys obviously they just fly on it. Because he knows how to have a conversation. Once you understand this, Harry, you know how to have a conversation with any individual that takes them to another level. And even just touching them a certain way when they say certain things. He'd be using something we called anchors. And I was teaching the guys to build these things up when I was working. But you're still up against it. But he was running the show. He was running everything. Everybody was aligned with him. And so, yeah, sadly, when he left, which wasn't a very pleasant time for us all as Celtic fans, the sad thing was he should have been able to have the time, arguably, to lay in the infrastructure so that he wasn't missed when he was when he left, and people were trained and understood the processes that he was using. But alas, it was all done, you know, as quick as it was. But
when you talk to Sven Jørgensen with the influencers,
yeah.
Again, one of the things that struck me, if you remember, at the end of the Ronnie Dyla period, there was these alleged bad influences in the dressing room that yes. were key people. And famously, Brendan Rodgers invites Scott Brown down to his house
yes.
for dinner, and yeah. Scott Brown becomes transformed. And I'm not saying, you know, I don't know the ins and outs, so I'm certainly not no. wanting to decry.
No.
But interestingly, the other influencers who are allegedly creating issues around the club at the time never played for Celtic under Brendan Rodgers.
Yeah. And it's the confidence, isn't it, to do that? We the feeling, you know, and I listen to podcasts, Celtic podcasts. The first thing I do, I walk a dog and I listen to podcasts. Celtic Underground is my favourite, Harry. But you
know, obviously.
And I go right the way back to Eddie and everyone else. You know, rainy nights and trains, coming back from a gig, listening to you guys. It was a dream. But the thing is, it's pretty obvious that everything isn't right. Because if it was right, they'd be winning. You wouldn't have players hiding, not wanting the ball. You wouldn't have a situation where, you know, centre-backs are coming forward with a ball, nobody's taking it off them. Nobody wants it. And they're not looking for it. No one's taking a risk. And Rangers know exactly how to play that. And the classic way for Celtic to lose a goal, you know, free kick or a corner in centre defence, don't know what to do with it. So the whole thing about what Brendan was able to do was change mindset and get the guys to understand it. And the obvious thing, I would have done the same if it was me. If you can't bounce, you get Bruni in and you sit him down and you really explain to him the whole thing. And you find out where's his head. Does he want to stay? Does he want to go? What would his vision be if he could have everything? It's not rocket science what he did. And he probably used the neuro-linguistic programming methodologies to really build Scott Brown up, to Scott to go in and immediately influence everybody. And those who couldn't handle it. But the funny thing was when Ronnie Dalia came along, he ran into trouble because he was changing the diet, if you remember. But the changes in diet he was wanting to change to are based on scientific fact and developing in sport, particularly team sports. So he did want to change diet. He did, but he had no credibility. And I can only imagine when he showed up, he would have got a certain reaction from certain people that would block him. So from day one, he's undermined. And from day one, that's going nowhere. So you could almost write the script. And unless, from my point of view, being a Celtic fan and having experience, but I haven't been in the football club for years. I'm working with corporates all the time. But to me, the way the things are just right now, I can't see Celtic winning the league. And I'm being, massive change has to happen. But the patterns have been running too long. Rangers know exactly how to play Celtic. They know how to play European clubs. They know how to play Celtic. They know how to play other clubs. Sometimes they can have an off day, so they don't win against Hibs, or they lose a point against Hamilton or whatever it is. They get knocked out of the Scottish Cup. So what? Gradually, slowly but surely, they're getting their act together. And every time in recent times Celtic's come up against them, we're just looking inadequate. So there needs to be a change. Whether Lenny can do it or not, I mean, I'd love him to get the whole thing sorted out. But I think most Celtic fans, if they're honest, have lost confidence at the moment. We need something to happen, maybe tomorrow night or Thursday night, rather. If you see something, and that might get us all together again.
I mean, you talked about Europe, and obviously I have my Ferencváros rant, which we'll get back to in a second. But just in general, one of the things I have talked about probably on the whole time I've been on this podcast, we make mistakes in European football. And we lose to teams in European football.
Yep.
If that team was in those mistakes wouldn't be made if that was an SPL, FL game. And those teams would be below us in the league if they were in the SPFL. And I have seen that under manager after manager, different players, different managers, different systems. So for me, our failure in European football, obviously at the very elite level, it's down to technical ability. But for me, our failure in European football is wholly down to mindset.
You're absolutely right. I mean, I've watched players and admitted to me privately in various clubs, including Celtic, that they're shitting themselves before they go out. Especially the intimidation of Celtic Park, 60,000 fans. And I've been in the middle of it, not with 60,000. I've been in Ibrox with 50,000, been in the middle of the ground. It's called Cup quarter-final thing, extra time, motivating the Aberdeen players. But you've been in Celtic when the guys are just playing and it's like a break and I'm going out. And there's no fans in. It's huge. It's massive. And if all the fans you go out there and the expectation on you, if you've not got a way of managing your mind, you're in trouble if you've got self-doubt. And most people have. And that's why I really wanted to get to work with them, to get them. And I never really got the chance to get really, really to that level. Some of them would come in, they would learn very quickly techniques for dealing with anxiety and fears and stuff. And Big Sammy, when he was there, I mean, he very quickly asked me, Sammy was phenomenal. And he would say, look, teach me how to deal with the anxiety, because I do get anxious, big games. And he was wide open to it. And so players that needed it and wanted it were willing to learn. It was most of them, to be honest. But you still had the lurkers in the background who were just naysayers. And the thing about football, which is really, really sad in many ways for people like yourself and I who just grew up with a passion for it, and for every team, not just Celtic, obviously, it's when you go and work with players and you realise they think it's just a job. And if it's Monday morning, they can't be bothered. I used to think, how does that happen? Mm-hmm. I'd give anything to be able to come here every day, but they don't see it that way. And so you've got these human beings with human emotions and stuff and having to cope with things, and there's 60,000 fans out there and you're about to go out and play AC Milan or some other big club in Europe, or some small club, and the fear is equally, because what if we don't win this today and somebody makes a mistake, and you can just see it all unfolding. But the reason for that, it goes back to what we said already. If Andy comes to Celtic Park, the first thing they should be handed is the dossier. They should be sat down and they should be introduced to the culture. And the culture is everybody aligned here to win the European Cup. That's just all it is. That's all we do, guys. That's what we're committed to. It might take us 20 years. It might take us 15. It might take us 5. But that's what we're committed to. And this is your role and this is what you're expected to do. And you must talk one another up. You must talk the manager up. You must talk the team up. You must talk everything up. And if you get a challenge with anything, then you come along and you raise it, and we will have an open mind to see if we can solve it. And we're all in this together. And it's like you slice them open. It's like stick a rock, and it's Celtic European Cup winners, and that's it. It's so simple. It's frightening, Harry. But most companies I go into work with, corporates, they know what they're, most of them, especially the entrepreneurial companies, they know exactly what it is, the vision is. Nobody knows, and all aligned to it. That's how they win. But if you go back to the basics as well, you've got the best footballer, in my opinion, in Scotland. Maybe people won't agree, but for me, that's McGregor. Mm-hmm. Callum McGregor is an unbelievably intelligent footballer. But like anybody else, he can have an off day. We're all human. But he's admitting in the last few days they didn't believe they could beat Rangers. He's admitted that. And if you think about it, where does that come from? From the clearly the best player in Scotland having doubt, because he's human, but nevertheless having the doubt against a team of players, Rangers, who all have got, in my opinion, they've got a phenomenal system. But let's be honest, we all see it, don't we? None of us would really want any of them to play for us, really.
No.
The odd one, but who really? Because our players, man for man, are better. But we don't have a system that's obvious, and players have doubt. For Callum McGregor, the best footballer in Scotland, to say we didn't believe is frightening. The three things you must have to win anything is you must have a desire. You must really, really want it. And it's pretty obvious. I remember when we stopped there 10 in a row, everybody, the whole of Celtic, the fans, the players, everybody was aligned to stopping that. So that's what it's like at Rangers at the moment. Everybody's aligned. So they're showing up with the desire to beat us. Because they've worked their system for 2.5 years, they believe in the system. And because of the, I'm going to suggest, Duco James type stuff, because that's been fed to them, because the coaching and the affirmations and all the stuff that we talked about, they turn up not only with the desire, the belief, but they expect to beat Celtic. They expect it, especially when they hear that they know the team ahead of you and I on the team, almost.
Well, see, based on what you're saying, initially my gut feel about them knowing the team was, who cares, right?
Yeah.
But actually, it's part of the rounded message of, we are building, we've got the best analytics team in Scotland that's behind you. We've got the best coaching staff in Scotland that's behind you. And an example of the fact that we've got the best of everything is, look at them. They're not, because they're leaking their team.
Yeah.
So they've got weaknesses.
Yeah.
We don't.
Yeah. That's it. As simple as that, Harry. And so when the player's great and then they soon realise, actually, this isn't going very well, and they lose a stupid goal, who's looking for the ball? Who's going to take the ball off of the centre-backs? Nobody.
I've heard Neil Lennon talking a lot about, we are missing the fans.
Aye, of course.
Do you think that could be a part? You know, one of the things from one of my mates, he's a fan of Neil Lennon, thinks he'll get it right. His point is, Rangers are benefiting from no fans because the pressure of stopping us from 10 in a row isn't on them, with the fans getting anxious every 10 seconds. We are missing the fans because our fans are not lifting the players when they need lifted. Do you think there's any truth in that?
Of course, I think you know, football is a spectator sport. Anyone who, if you think about dynamics of energy, it's no coincidence that teams tend to win at home throughout history. They tend to win at home. And that's because of the energy and the dynamic. And it does push you along, or it stifles you. And so typically when we see Rangers going wrong, the fans turn on them very, very quickly. And it's pretty, from what you can see and hear, it's pretty evil. And so players, if you're weak-skinned or you're not understanding how you manage yourself, that must be pretty frightening for some of those players. And so they collapse, like they did the start of this year, under the pressure. Their bottle, as we say, goes. But Celtic doesn't have the 60,000 fans pulling and pushing them along. And I think we would agree that if there was fans in that match on Saturday watching what was going on, they would never let that happen. The fans would have been absolutely furious, you know, and it would have done something. We would imagine that Bruni would have done something or whatever. He seemed to be lost as well in it all.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying they weren't trying. I think they were probably doing the best they could with the resources they had in the moment. But their mind, they'd lost their belief. And I go back to it. For the best footballer in Scotland to lose his belief in himself, it's frightening. And that says a lot about the whole thing that's going on there. And sometimes these things are not any particular person's fault. Everybody's doing the best they can. But it's got so bad, the lack of belief, let's say, and the lack of, if you go back to the start of last year when we started playing and we were playing so well, and it was like there was just matches where it was superb and it's all gone. How does it go? Have they fallen out with one another? Are they not playing for one another? Do they not like the new guys? Have the new guys come in and upset the old guys? Or, you know, what is going on? So you don't know. And then you're looking at Lenny sitting there putting his snuff in his mouth, and you're going, you know, what is going on? And he's calming himself. I can understand he's calming himself down with that, but actually we might need some of his passion at that point instead of calming down. But you see the Rangers dugout team they're all active, they're all animated, they're all thinking it through and figuring it out, and they've got their eye on the goal, and we don't seem to be talking to one another.
Yeah, do you know, that's the thing I've said to people a few times, because much as I have been critical of Neil Lennon, a lot has been made of, in the second time at Celtic, that Neil Lennon is not on the training ground every day, that the coaching is being done by Kennedy, and it was Duff, and now it's Strachan Jr. Yeah. They're doing a lot of the training. And the first games of the season, the thing that struck me was when the camera panned to the dugout, Lennon's sitting on his own with his arms folded, yeah, shaking his head or whatever. And I thought initially that was to do with social distancing measures.
Yes.
But I really noticed on Saturday, it would go to Neil Lennon sitting on his own, and it would go to the Rangers dugout, and they were sitting next to each other, and Beale would be talking to Gerrard about what was going on the pitch. And the thing that struck me is, if the day-to-day training is being taken by Kennedy and Strachan, but on match day, yeah, there's no sharing of ideas, there's no mutual discussion, there's no sharing the problem, there's no discussion, there's no sharing the challenge to talk about how they can overcome what the issue is on the pitch. That I really noticed that on Saturday, because yeah, the camera kept panning between the two, and the isolation of Neil Lennon for me was a major issue. There's more than Neil Lennon is the issue there, if that's the point.
Exactly, and I actually felt sorry for him. You know, I'm letting God, you've not got support. There's something not right about what's going on, especially when you see that it wasn't to do with social distancing, because the Rangers players were able to do what they were doing, backroom staff, and they were getting on with it, and they were animated and excited. We had a suppression of energy. Mm-hmm. They were all just glum. You know, there was nothing coming from them. That was pretty worrying, and that's been for a few matches that I've watched and or, you know, listened to. You just get the impression. I live in Canterbury, so I don't get up, but you get the impression that it's just not. There's no cohesion. And the other thing I would say too is, he's a relatively new manager, the Rangers manager, relatively new. Into the field, and he's got a young team around him. We've got a young team as well. But when did they do their training? And when are they updating their training? I mean, if Neil 15 years ago or whatever did his training as a manager, he's got 15-year-old ideas. If he's talking to the managers that before him that inspired them, even you know, the great managers, they've got old ideas. They probably haven't. I'm not being, but you can imagine they might not be up for the Duco Jameses of this world. Whereas these younger guys are, you know, they're open minded and they're getting fed some of the stuff, the enlightened stuff that's coming from Klopp.
One of the things that stuck in my mind again about the lack of interaction between, I mean,
yes.
This is only from what I can see on yeah, watching the telly, so it's limited. Yeah, yeah. But the lack of interaction between John Kennedy and Neil yeah, Lennon, yeah, again, last season in the interviews with Neil Lennon and after achieving the 9 in a row, I remember Lennon being interviewed and he was talking about having this more detached attitude so that when he spoke to the yeah, players, it might have more gravitas yeah, to it. But also, he talked about how he leaves all the tactics and all that type of stuff to John Kennedy, because that's what the young players are used to and expect. Yeah. And he was talking like an old man. That's mm-hmm, what I felt. He was talking like someone of, I'm of a different generation. That's John Kennedy's thing. So I'll leave John Kennedy to talk to the players about that. Right, that's fine. So my concern this season, watching it, is if that type of thing is what the young players expect, in-depth on analysis on tactical, direct one-to-one tactical instruction.
Yeah.
And that's given by John Kennedy, and there is no interaction between John Kennedy and Neil Lennon during match day, which every time the camera pans, there's none.
Yeah.
Then what the players are interacting with on a daily basis from the coach is different from the message that they're receiving on match day, is my concern.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, if you go back to the notion of they should all get the, you know, if they were all aligned to the same vision and they get the dossier when you arrive. I thought when Neil went back the second time, I was concerned for the young players who would have lived under Brendan and would have been coached and talked to, and I'm going to use this word, nurtured by that intellect and all of the resources that he would have. A very bright, modern manager, let's say. And then Neil comes in. Neil, you know, I love him a bit, and I've had the pleasure of sitting in his company and working with him. If Neil doesn't have the resources to keep up with what's going on and fully understand the range of resources that Brendan had, and you're a young player who's been inspired, and suddenly a guy speaking in a different kind of way, and is possibly even occasionally doing a 15-year back generational managers type thing, you might be going, what am I doing here? And then I also thought, you know, how come Rangers, we know we can go into their finances, and because while I was listening to you all the time, I was also listening to reading Rangers tax case all the time. So I was in fact, I'd go up to Celtic Park and tell them all about it because they didn't know anything about it. I'd say, let's see what's happening to Rangers, but that's another story. But the thing is, if you're a young player and you get the chance to go and work with the Rangers manager and all his history and credibility, and or you could go and work with Neil Lennon, and a guy who is a coach but actually got injured when he was a young man and never really did anything with the game. But we've got these guys that come from Liverpool. Who are you going to sign for? Who are you going to be excited to? And okay, we all get the impression maybe Stevie or Slippy Stevie or Stevie G or whatever isn't maybe that good a manager, but the guy beside him is a bloody good coach. So and you can see if they sit down and say, look, it's going to take us 2 years or whatever, we're not going to win anything maybe, we're just going to take abuse, but we're going to put this system in. We're going to work it and work it and work it, and you'll be able to do it in your sleep. And we will do well in Europe, and every year we will progress. And finally, hopefully in time, we stop there 10, we'll win the league. And you go to Celtic, and it doesn't seem like there's alignment. Although this year, surprisingly, Neil got he got the players he wanted. He certainly got money, which was not like them.
No.
But maybe not in time. But maybe not necessarily the right players. You know?
So somebody might turn around, listen to this and go, wow, you're being incredibly down. This is a manager who's two wins away from a treble carrying over from last season. Are you not being overly, to be the opposite of what you would normally be, are you not being too negative here?
Well, I have said, I mean, I love him to bits and I want him to succeed. I want him to succeed. But what I'm saying is, look, I believe you can turn it around, provided everybody is aligned. And it's like, there needs to be a sit down and conversation, because even if inside the camp everything's fine and it's just been one of these days, the dynamic around them, I used to say to them, don't read the newspapers, don't listen to the radio, but they go and read the newspapers and they go and listen to the radios and probably listen to Harry Brady. And the thing is, they do, and that's influencing them as well. Unless they're protected from all of that, they know that there seems to be something wrong, and it needs to be, if it's tackled and it's talked through and it's all clarified, and Neil, because Neil can be brilliant at it, get absolutely motivated, then you lift up and you start taking risks again. And it's down to, so I would say to players, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, what's your desire like for this particular match or for this tournament? What's your belief that you'll win it? Back to the thing about Rangers. And what's your expectation? Scale of 1 to 10. And it's very easy to say, well, actually, I've got the desire, but I don't believe it. So you have to work on belief. Or you have to work on each of these, sometimes all of them, or you have to work on specific ones to shift the dial. But as you said already, it's all mindset. So look, I'm I believe it's possible. I ultimately believe you can work with them. They need people to work with them. And I think they're obviously needing help, because it's not as if it's a one-off match, Harry. This is a trend that's been going on for a long time now. And it's been a trend that's been going on since the start of this season. It could be the fans not being in and all the rest of it. Of course, it's adding, could be adding some weight to it. It does seem it's tight. It needs to be a change. And hopefully, as I've said already, Wednesday night we get a change. But the thing that I see is there's so many, it's like an onion skin. There's so many parts of the onion skin that need to be peeled back and put to bed. You have to ask, someone has to have the balls to ask the greatest footballer in Scotland at the moment, say, why did you not believe? What makes up that lack of belief? Where's that coming from? And so once you understand it, okay, how do we reverse? How do we get you not to think like that? Because I've got tools and techniques, but nevertheless, lots of other people have. How can we get you to have a different type of thought? Because if you believe, if he's believing, then he's taking more risks with his passing. He's not just playing square balls and balls back the way. And it's the same as Wee Frimpong or the new. I thought the new guy looked like he's probably going to be okay. But the thing is, is he going to risk? He's a new guy. Is he going to risk? And Frimpong, he never get the ball in the right place. He wasn't able to take the ball.
It's interesting you mentioned there about risk, because again, this is something I have thought watching the team this season, and I like my cricket.
Yes.
And I was listening to a podcast like you. I was listening to a podcast over the summer, and it was talking about the change of mindset in the England cricket team.
Yeah.
That had got them into being the best one day, both 50 over and 20 over team in the world. Yeah. They had got to lots of finals and never won them. And it was because of a risk averseness. They had the talent and they were getting to finals, but it was a risk averseness. And somebody was talking about Owen Morgan changed the mindset. And the attitude was everybody was allowed to take a risk because they had ultimate faith that the next batsman in I was the best number one. You were the best. We were the best opening batsman. I was best number one in the world. You are the best number two. And you know what? The guy who's number three is the best number three in the world. And the guy who's number four is the best number four in the world. So you and I can take all the risks we like, because if I fail, number three will come in and bat with you and it'll be fine. And number three can take the risk, because if he fails, number four will come in and take the risk. And I was listening to this, and then we start playing games and we're 60% possession, 70% possession against Ferencvaros and don't win the game. Why? Because we took no risks with the passes.
Exactly. And that's why we've, for some strange reason, a team that was taking risks all the time and playing beautiful football have got themselves into a mindset where they're not taking risks and players are hiding. You know, when the big Norwegian fella is driving forward with a ball, nobody's looking for the ball off him. They're not giving him runs. Or he's not seeing the run. Partly, I'm going to suggest, if you don't believe in yourself, you don't even see the run. It's on, because your brain's not letting you find it, because you're looking for failure. You know, it's what we're talking about, the negativity versus the positivity.
Yeah.
And sadly, we've got this malaise or a kind of fog, you know, or mental fog or mind fog that's on. It seems to be there. It probably wouldn't take much to shift it. I hope that Neil can, because I really love the guy. But if we can't do something soon, we're going to have to do something different.
You say you love the guy, so you heard the Ferencvaros. Was I over the top in the Ferencvaros podcast? I've got two people who want to come on and berate me for it if I've been over the top.
I can understand that, but I think I was absolutely delighted you were on. I needed it. You know, everybody needed it. You need something, and it was Harry Brady, thank God. Because I've always rated you. I mean, I think what you do is fantastic, and I loved it. And I particularly remember, you know, there's some George Galloway interview. My God, phenomenal stuff. You know, the stuff that you guys have done is just amazing. And the guys that come on, I can't get. So it was so good that night to see. Oh God, Harry Brady. And you just said exactly what I was thinking. And I would have said the same thing. And Neil, by the way, would have said the same thing to you. You know, if you had been the manager and the thing had happened the way it happened, you just, especially as you're quite rightly saying, waiting so long to make a change, if something isn't working, well, that's that thing about madness, isn't it? You know, you keep doing the thing because you hope it's going to...
Well, again, and that was the thing that I've heard a lot of ex-players and coaching, people who coach footballers, the thing that they keep talking about was that our changes on Saturday were, you know, I said this to someone at halftime. I said, look, the problem we've got for me is where our number 10 is playing. And somebody replied back to me saying, we've not got a number 10. And I said, exactly. We've not got someone behind the Rangers midfield, between the defence and the midfield, making the midfield turn and look behind. We had a flat three, more or less, in the middle of the park. And then when we make the change, we take off Klamala, who's been ineffectual because he's a penalty box striker, not getting the ball, whatever you think his abilities, and we replace him with a penalty box striker.
I know.
And the stuff I've read from football people is the problem was the change we made in that game was not a change of system. It was swapping like for like with personnel. So it was plan B was to try plan A harder.
Aye, exactly. Exactly. And that's the unfortunate thing. The great managers are able to change it. And to some extent, I thought he was doing that last year. He was changing it from time to time. I mean, obviously, Brendan Rodgers seemed to be able to do it very, very well. But you're sitting there, when are you going to make a change? When are you going to make a change? And even at half-time, you're thinking, this is all going pear-shaped. We need to make a change. And especially five. You know, for God's sake, you get five chances. Why not do something different? Because I think it's not like, at the end of the day, it's sad for players like Klamala. These guys are probably very good footballers. But you're put into a situation where around you people don't believe in themselves or in the team. You're on to hiding to nothing because there's no way the ball's getting to you. No, you know, you can see him running. He's looking for a ball, but nobody's going to give it to him.
Yep.
Because they're scared to give it. They're scared to play the pass to him in case it goes wrong. So they play the safe pass. And this is all we do with psychology. It's all mindset, Harry. This is what you can be the greatest footballer in the world, but if your mind's not right, there's no point. And equally, you can be a pretty crappy footballer and your mind's right and you do really well. Guess what Rangers are? Crappy footballers doing really well because of great mindset.
So I'm gonna ask for a bit of freebie advice for people, anybody listening, right? You're talking about getting in the right mindset. So I'm gonna use two examples from me personally, and then I'm gonna ask you for a technique to deal with this, right?
All right, okay.
So if I think to when I played sport, right? I used to play football in goals, used to play cricket, and I still play golf, right? And I can't think of any particular thing that I would get wrong in the football, not to say I was doing it right, but there was nothing in particular, but cricket, right? I actually would drop dollies, easy catches,
right,
when I used to play cricket, because I once dropped an easy catch.
Yes.
Thereafter, I always think this about strikers one-on-one with a goalkeeper, the concept of having too much time to think about it.
Yeah.
The biggest point I have negative thoughts when I'm playing golf is over a short putt, because you shouldn't miss that one. Okay, it's okay to miss the 12-foot putt, but you shouldn't miss the 2-foot putt.
Yes.
So I'm actually more likely to miss the 2-foot putt than the 12-foot. So how, if anybody can then think of those types of, how do I deal with, if I use that example, and how would anybody deal with the, I have missed some short putts, therefore every time I now stand over a 2-foot putt, not on my own, see when I'm playing on my own, I sink every one of them.
Yeah.
When I'm playing with other people, what is a way of dealing with that?
Well, it's funny enough, it's the same as what you'd be doing with the Celtic team at the moment. It's what is your self-talk, right? You know, so McGregor's self-talk obviously isn't helpful because he didn't believe. But so your situation is you're self-talking yourself into missing putts. And your brain just says, okay. So if you're thinking something, you're seeing yourself missing putts, your brain just says okay, and therefore you miss the putt. Going back to a famous experience of mine, and I'll come right back to you. I get the chance to work with the Scottish rugby squad, and I'm with Gavin Hastings. And back to my point about winning the European Cup, that particular year, the World Cup the World Cup in rugby takes place in the UK, and Scotland get to the semi-final against England at Murrayfield. Previous year, they beat the English no bother at Murrayfield, but this is a semi-final of the World Cup. Now, before I go any further, not one single journalist, not one single player, nor the manager, nobody in Scotland believed at the outset they could win it. But the England people think they can win it. So the match kicks off, and Scotland go 3-0, England equalise. 6-0, England equalise. Penalty kick for Scotland. I'm calling it a penalty kick. I don't know too much about rugby. But the thing is, he's got this penalty thing. It's right in front of the posts. It's in the middle. It's not even at the side. It's in the middle. I used to joke on the stage, you could just backheel it and it would go over. Mm-hmm. And he does that big fancy walk back thing he does. But as he's putting the ball down, some of the players, his brother and some of the other players are going back, come on, Gavin, this is it. They'll never come back. And they're giving him, come on, big man. And he puts the ball down, does all that fancy back walk thing. And just before he's about to run, he thinks to himself, what if I miss? Bing! The ball goes off and he misses. That's what you're doing, Harry. What you're doing is you've got a mindset that says I miss easy putts. What you need to do is you need to reframe all of that, and you need to. I use a simple catchphrase, which is delete that program. Because what I used to teach was, like, every thought you have is a program to your brain. Your brain's like a hardware. The software is your programming, which is your thoughts. Your brain, your whole body will perform what you tell it. So what you've got to do is, the next time you think I miss easy putts, you say to yourself, delete that program. I'm going to putt easy. I'm going to sink easy putts. I sink easy putts. And you self-talk yourself. And famously, I remember playing a guy who I played with some people in the circuit, and I've worked with him, and I was playing with a guy in California. This is the way it was. And I'm working with this guy, and I put a different thing altogether, but he's a major golfer. And he self-talks himself every single hole. He would say to himself, okay, I'm going to play a 9-iron now, and I'm going to play exactly to there. And he was just self-talking. The whole thing was self-talked. Every single part of the game was phenomenal to observe it. And 90% of the time, he was absolutely accurate where he landed the ball and so on. Whereas I'm playing golf, and I'm just hoping I can get the bloody thing up the centre, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm not thinking about specifically where to lay it. But they, of course, they're world champions. But that's what you need to do. You need your self-talk is your issue. And it's been going on, you say you're 50 now, so it's been going on since you were a boy playing golf.
Yeah.
And that's, but that's also the case going back to the football, you know. You can get into a cycle, like, we never beat Rangers. And I've never played well against Rangers, you know, and you can see where that goes, yeah.
I always felt that under Tommy Burns. Tommy yeah. Burns talked too much about
yeah.
Andy Gorham was going to break his heart. And
yeah, God bless the guy. I've got a wee Tommy Burns story, if you just
okay. Quick. Yeah.
The BBC turned up and asked if they could do a documentary about my work, and sat down with a producer guy, and it was going to be an hour-long documentary in the BBC, and it did happen. But they came with me all over the place, filming me doing gigs in London and working with companies and all sorts of stuff. And one of the things, they wanted to see me working with some sports people, and nothing came up. I was doing something for a team who were playing Hibs in the Scottish Cup. I think it was one of the cups, I don't even remember now. It was up in the East Coast, one of the sort of third division clubs or something. And Celtic were due to play at Parkhead Rangers in the New Year game. But Sky TV had the rights for it, and the BBC, but now they're filming with me and we're getting this programme again. I said, it would be great if we get you to talk to Celtic. But we'd need to get permission of Sky, because they own the rights for the building or something. We'd just like you to be maybe with the players or something. And I said, I'd like that as well, because at this point I've not worked with them yet. And so anyway, long story short, I got the chance to go and speak to Tommy. And I go in and speak to Tommy and explain what I do. And what was interesting was he was very nervous of it, because you remember we were beaten by Raith Rovers in the
mm-hmm. yeah. league.
That was devastating for Tommy, because that was a real low point. And he, when I went in to see him, I was seeing what I could do for myself, you know, but I don't need the media thinking I need Jack Black, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And quite a few managers would tell me that. I don't need to be found out that I've got you in here. It was a big issue for them, and I respected that, which is part of the reason why you sign confidentiality agreements and stuff. But so anyway, he agreed that he would go and see the wee guy with a bonnet to see if we could do this. He wanted me to work with him. I said, okay, I would come in about 2 or 3 days before it and blah, blah, blah. And then on the day, and I explained it all to him, he was right up for it. And he then would go off and see if he could see the boss and get it sorted out. And of course, he said, well, what do you want to get paid for this? Well, as Martin O'Neill famously said, you would crawl up the road on your knees. And I said, to be honest, I don't need anything, just the, you know. And he said, I know, but I said, well, I can tell you what, you know, the Jock Stein Lounge, you know, give me a couple of tickets for that if you can, and my father can go and, you know, I think at the time it was like, I don't know, about a grand or something, whatever it was. And I said, you know, that would be fine. Because he quite rightly wanted to pay something, and I was just wanting the gig,
yep,
to help Celtic. And anyway, long story short, I've got to, BBC are on my case now. So when are we filming and all the rest of it? I said, well, we're definitely doing something, but it's not getting absolutely tied down the dates. I gave him some dates and blah, blah, blah. And I'm phoning Tommy. They're putting me under pressure. I'm phoning Tommy, and I can't get him to answer and all the rest of it. So one day I'm in Glasgow doing something, and I think I'll just drive out to Celtic Park and see if he's there. I drive out, and I go into the reception here, and I say, look, Jack Black here, I want to speak to Tommy. Him and I have got something going on. I'm sure if you say I'm here, he'll maybe arrange. I can stay all afternoon till he's, you know, he's ready, and blah blah blah. And so they got me through. So he's busy at the moment, but he said okay, you can wait. And I waited about an hour, and then I waited about an hour and a half, and then there was the fire alarm went off, and all the players and all the staff and the whole building was emptying because of this fire alarm. And I was like, Tommy hasn't come out yet. And then Davy Hay comes out, because he was at that point doing whatever he did for the club. And I had worked with him before. He said, oh, Jack, what are you doing here? And I said, oh, I've got this thing arranged with Tommy and stuff. But I think he's hiding from me. He's in that building. I said, I think he is. And he had a way in to find him. And he sheepishly said, okay. And because it was obviously a false alarm. He said, okay, you can wait half an hour. So eventually I get in and sat in his office. Same office I sat in when I went to see Billy McNeil years before. And Liam Brady. I've got great stories. But anyway, I'm in his office. And he says to me, I can't get the money off the wee man. He'll not even give you a seat. And I was like, joking. He said, no. And to be honest, I'm really still nervous about the League Cup thing and getting this getting... height. So just finally, because of that, I did some work with the Scottish team before the last European Championships when Denmark won. Mm-hmm. And I did some work with them, and it got on really well. And it was all over a Sunday newspaper that the then manager, what's his name, you know, he's with UEFA now,
Andy Roxburgh,
some media character was slagging him off because he needed me to come in. And of course, I was due to go with him to Denmark and I'd get the bullet. And the managers from that point had to be very careful. And God rest his soul, Tommy was a brilliant guy. But really, he was really funny about it as well. He said, I'm hiding from you because I don't want to let you down. But he was great. And he would always call you, it doesn't matter what age you were, I was older than him, he would still call you son.
So, we've got a game on Thursday against AC Milan.
Aye, thank God.
Do you think that external environment might help mentally? You know, in terms, I know it's the same ground, but it's not the league. It's not Rangers. It's not the league. Yeah. Do you think that's a way that the players can change their mindset because they're in a different environment? Can that help?
Yeah, I mean, again, if we go back to it and we think, okay, it's just been a bleep. And it's just been a pattern that they can break out of, and Neil breaks them out and they all get their act together and Bruni gets them going again. It's the perfect match, isn't it? It's not going out to play Hamilton or something. It's all stymied. You can't imagine AC Milan of today are going to come and park the bus. So you're going to get a proper football match. So it's a very good chance, I think. And I obviously, going back to believing in positive, I'd like to hope so, that everything comes together on Thursday night. And then obviously Aberdeen, it's got to come together there.
Yeah, it has. Well, with that, I will see Jack Black of Mindstore. I'll put that in to remind people because it was at the beginning. I'll say thanks very much.
Yes, Harry. Pleasure speaking to you. And you are a hero of mine, by the way.
Bring me sunshine in your smile. Now, we mentioned the Ferris Farris game on that podcast there, and I have to admit there were a number of people who agreed with me on that, and there was also a number of people who thought I was a bit too severe. Some of the people, actually, I don't think listened to the whole podcast, because halfway through we got St. Anthony on, who was much different to Anthony and I. And at the end of the podcast, I admitted that we were probably too severe and said we were probably right. But anyway, I did say to a couple of them that I would get them on the podcast for the right of reply, but work, and more work has got in the way in the last wee while. So there will be more podcasts coming along soon. Fantastic work announced this week by the Celtic FC Foundation, that working with the Celtic Football Club and the fans, that they've managed to raise nearly £1 million. During this terrible pandemic. So incredible work by them. And if you want to do anything for them, log online, Celtic FC Foundation, Football for Good campaign, etc. Anyway, enough of me. We get AC Milan on Thursday. Hope you enjoyed that podcast. Don't know if I'll get out of the room, my head's so big after Jack Black saying that I was a hero of his at the end there. Anyway, enough of that. It's me, Harry Beery, saying good night and God bless. And if you are interested in what Jack was talking about, you can go on to mindstore.com and you'll see a wee bit more about it. Anyway, good night, God bless, take care.
Bring me love, sweet love, bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me